Hello there. Radio 1 proudly presents in two programs the members of Queen, talking about themselves and their music. Queen, as they are now, were formed in February 1971 and have become one of the most successful rock acts in the world, with over 6 major albums and 10 hit singles. Well, let me introduce you now to the members of Queen. First of all, vocalist and piano player...
Freddie Mercury.
On guitar and arranging and writing...
Brian May, I'm here.
On drums...
And occasional vocals, Roger Taylor. Yeah.
Welcome, Roger. And on bass and electric piano...
John Deacon.
Right. Together they've sold over 40 million records worldwide. That's quite something. And first of all, if I can ask you, Freddie, how did it all begin?
Very sort of briefly. Brian and Roger, they were in a sort of very up-tempo, raucous band called Smile. And I used to be in another band called Wreckage or something.
More up-tempo, the even name like Wreckage.
Even more up-tempo. And we used to be friends, I mean, you know, going to college together and sort of met up. And after sort of a couple of years of knowing each other, we just decided we'd form a band together, really. As simple as that. We thought our musical ideas would blend. Then we met John and decided to call the band Queen.
Roger, can we go to the beginnings of the group? You and Freddie were... working, or you had a stall right in the Kensington market.
Yes, Partners in Crime.
Partners in Crime.
Yes, it was really just, it was more of a sort of social centre, I think, at the time. At the time, that Queen was sort of in its formative stages, and we were going through all their traumas with trying to find somebody to manage us and find a record company, etc. We sort of slogged our way around, made some demo tapes, etc., through some friends, and then sort of hawked them round the business, as it was, and still is, eventually sort of securing ourselves several companies who were interested. We then did a gig, I think it was at King's College, somewhere down in South London, and got a load of record companies along. And then we started to sort of try and wheel and deal a bit our way into a sort of good recording situation.
How long did it take you from the time that you'd made the demo to the time that you actually got a recording contract?
It felt like about 80 years, I think.
It was a long time. It was about 2 years.
It was about 18 months, 2 years, yeah.
There was a great deal of feeling of frustration at the time. The first album was really old songs by the time it came out, as far as we were concerned. And it put us in a strange position because there were a lot of... We were sort of one of the groups who came along with a show and a sort of an idea of a complete production as a stage show and everything. Whereas by the time the record came out, and particularly by the time it got played by anyone and all this, I mean, it takes so long to get things going, it was all sounding like old news, you know, so people were inclined to... tag us as the tail end of glitter rock or something.
We've had a fairly sour relationship with the music press, as it's called in this country.
You don't like the music press, I understand.
No, to be perfectly honest, no.
But from the very sort of beginning, I think, as far as I say the musical press are concerned, I mean, they like, I mean, even now, they like to sort of put sort of up-and-coming bands into a sort of particular bag for what they think. And I think we sort of just rebelled. I mean, we wanted to sort of do what we thought was right and not sort of go along with what they were saying. And I think since the very early stages, there's always been this sort of fracas between...
Yes, it started from day one, with the release of our first album. Plus the fact that before our first actual release, we were virtually totally unheard of, and then suddenly we were not particularly famous, but heard of at least. And they always like to think they've got one up on you, and they always like to think they've predicted something.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden there we were, and we were playing to quite a lot of people. And it took people rather by surprise, I think.
Was this style, though, that you had created, was that thought out from the outset, or did it just evolve as time went by?
There were certain kind of ideals which we had in our heads, definitely certain patterns that we wanted to try and live up to. And I think, to put it crudely, we started off thinking that we wanted to be a kind of heavy group, but with good melodies and with good harmonies. And the other things grew out of that. And the first album was really just putting down what we did on stage at the time. It was quick into the studios and quick out. Even at that time, lots of big ideas about what we could do in a studio if we were let loose for a proper time in the studio. But we saved all that up to Queen 2, the second album. But a lot of the Queen 2 stuff was written at the time we made the first album.
OK, well, let's take some music now from Queen 1. The first track we're going to play is like your first single taken at Queen 1, Keep Yourself Alive. Keep Yourself Alive, your first single. Brian, were you disappointed that this didn't do better?
Oh, yes, yes. It takes me back very vividly to the time, actually, because this is just the time when we started. We did a few gigs on our own, some small gigs, and then went on the support tour with Mott the Hoople, and went around the whole country getting really good reactions and thinking, yeah, we're really getting somewhere. And yet all the time we were watching the single and the album and nothing appeared anywhere in the charts, you know. And it just seemed like an impossible wall. We thought, how is it done? You know, we couldn't get the single played on the radio at all, hardly. Well, there's a couple of people that played it, but it didn't get any sort of power play. But there's no doubt that the beginning is the worst. You know, you have no track record, you have no reputation. Yeah.
John, can I come to you now? We haven't heard you from you, I'm sorry. You got a degree in electronics. Did this mean that the group all came to you and asked you questions when they had complicated bits of machinery to look at?
Not particularly. I used to help a little out in the early days, you know, when we, you know, basically when we started out, there was just the four of us and one guy, our roadie, John Harris, who's been with us right from the beginning. And between me and him, we used to do a lot in the early days. But now we have quite a larger crew of about 20 who look after it all for us.
Well, being in a 32-track studio with all the marvellous space-age electronics all around, do you find it difficult to sort of keep your hands off little buttons and say, what's this, what's that?
Well, we do. We all of us try to learn what the studio does. I mean, because it helps to get the sounds and the ideas and to do what you want. And we've all taken interest in what it is possible to do in a studio, technically. You know, because, I mean, I think if a musician doesn't understand that, it limits, you know, the ideas that they can actually put down on tape.
Now, you were playing bass,
yes.
First of all, with Roger?
No, I basically, I came down to London to university, and I was here for about 2 years. I wasn't playing at all. I used to play before I came to university in sort of groups at school and things like that, and then I gave it up when I came down. And after I was here for about 2 years, I bumped into, I think it was Roger and Brian somewhere, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I heard, just socially, because they happened to be at different colleges around the same area in London, and I heard they were looking for a bass player. So I said I was interested, and went along for an audition, really. And it happened like that. I think you've been together for about 6 months previously, haven't you?
I think longer, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean Queen, yeah.
Queen, with the name Queen.
No, going through about three bass players a week at the time.
Yeah.
And we eventually found John.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, I seemed to fit in, and, you know.
Did you immediately agree on the kind of music you wanted to play?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, they were already formed. They had all the musical ideas then of what they were trying to do, and I just, you know, and I basically, you know, just fitted in really at that time.
He's very modest. Yeah.
Well, my development came later. It took me a few years to settle in.
Well, John, now it's your personal choice. What would you like to play?
Yes,
now?
I'd chosen a track by Marvin Gaye. Heard it through the grapevine. I like a lot of these American sort of Tamla things, but for the bass players, some of the bass players are very
Tamla
nice.
Things.
You know,
love it.
You know, and it's a nice atmospheric song.
Okay, here it is. Marvin Gaye, Headed Through the Grapevine. John, you are a family man. Am I right in...?
Sort of correct, yes. Yes. I have one little boy, yes.
Yes, right. Yeah. Do you find it difficult touring in the States and being away from family?
It can be a strain, yeah. I try and make the two work together, you know, which can be difficult, but I try and fit it in.
How does he react to Daddy being a big star?
Well, I don't know, he can't talk yet.
How do you think he will react?
I don't know, I'll see then. Yeah, he's just starting to talk now, actually, so I'll find out what he's been thinking.
John is also the business brain of the group.
He's the business brain?
Mm. I tend to look into that a bit, yeah, some of that.
So you're examining the contracts and checking on the returns and...
Well, yeah, it is nice, it is, especially when you get to the level... We got to. I mean, it's nice to know what's going on.
Brian, you did a degree in physics, and then you went on to do a PhD in astronomy.
Yeah.
What was the attraction of astronomy?
Something I'd always been interested in. As a kid, I used to look at the stars, and I built a telescope and things. And it was just something I thought, if I ever had the chance to be an astronomer, I would give it a go. So I took a physics degree, and I... I mean, when you're at school, you don't really know what you're going to do. I think it's still true. You know, when you come out of school, you tend to do what you're best at, and if you happen to be good at physics, everyone tells you you should do physics. So I did that, and it happened to be a good thing to lead on to astronomy. So I did some research in astronomy after I got the degree. But at that time, the group began to take off and demand more and more time. So it just became impossible to carry on with the studies, really.
But I believe your PhD thesis, in fact, was practically completely written, wasn't it?
Yes, I did. I spent a long time. I also taught for a while at a comprehensive school to make the money to keep going, and did most of the writing up. But it's just for the sake of that last bit. Mm. And I seriously wonder whether it's ever going to get done now.
And what was the thesis on?
Interplanetary dust, motion of dust between us and the sun.
Oh, very cosmic.
Cosmic. Is there a lot of it? Is there a lot of it?
Yes, there's a surprising amount of it, actually, yes. You can, in fact, see it if you're in the right place at the right time. In a very clear sky, in a very dark sky, you can see...
Tell them about your zodiacal light.
It's called the zodiacal light, yes.
Oh, there you are.
Which is a sort of milky glow, which looks something like the Milky Way, but it's a cone of light which stretches up with the sun as a centre.
Hmm. Where did you observe from? Because I'd have thought London sky at night was a bit murky.
Oh, yes. Well, I went to Tenerife. Well, I went to Italy first, in the Italian Alps. We had an observatory there, but that was plagued with bad weather. And we went to Tenerife. We set up an observatory on Tenerife. I actually organised a hut being built, which had not actually a telescope, but a spectroscope, which is what I used.
Well, let's hear some more music, and what we have coming up is The Seven Seas of Rye. I do like to be beside the seaside. Well, that was the single that broke you, The Seven Seas of Rye, that began it all. Roger, why was there a little bit of Seven Seas of Rye on Queen 1 and then repeated on Queen 2?
Well, I think Freddie had half written the song, mm-hmm. and we thought it was a nice sort of tail out to the first album. I think we had the idea of starting the second album with the song.
With the finished song, yeah.
So it would sort of lead in nicely. Yeah. In fact, we ended the second album with this song. And it had changed a little by then. And we released it as a single because we thought it was fairly strong. Mm.
Freddie, if I could count to you as the man what wrote it, the lyrics, what does it mean?
Oh, God, you should never ask me that. my lyrics are sort of basically for people's interpretations, really. I mean, I think it's... I've forgotten what they're all about.
What were the Seven Seas of Rye?
It's really fictitious. I know it's like sort of bowing out, an easy way out, but that's basically what it is. It's just a figment of your imagination. Really.
You have a rather a surrealistic approach. Is that the right word, could I say, to your lyrics?
Good for them. An imaginative approach, yes.
No, but it's
an easy way out. Covers such a lot of area. It really depends on what kind of song, really. I think at that time I was learning about a lot of things, about actual song structure, and as far as lyrics are concerned, they're very difficult as far as I'm concerned. I find them quite a task, and my strongest points are, like, say, melody, content, and I basically sort of concentrate on that first, the melody and the song structure, and then the lyrics come afterwards, actually.
Are you influenced by Salvador Dali?
Not really. I sort of admire him, yes. It's not as involved as that. I don't sort of take things like paintings too literally. The only time I did do that was in a song called Fairy Fella's Masterstroke, where I actually sort of was thoroughly inspired by a painting by Richard Dadd, which is in the Tate Gallery. And I thought that sort of... did a lot of research on it, and it sort of inspired me to write a song about the painting, depicting what I thought I saw in it.
What did you discover in your research about this painting?
It's just because, I mean, I've come through art college and things like that. I basically liked the sort of artist, and sort of liked the painting, and I thought I'd like to sort of write a song about it.
But we're going to play this track, so...
It's on Queen 2.
Thank you.
It's one of our first major experiments in stereo, I think.
Mm. How do you sort out which songs are going to go onto an album? Because you all write, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes.
We row.
Yeah.
Argue.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do write individually, so I mean, like, so we go our separate ways for whenever the tour's over or whatever. And then we sort of have a routining period where we sort of get together and sort of play each other the new songs. And then what happens is a sort of a very huge sifting process where we sort of find out what songs...
Like, no way am I going to play that, or...
Things like that. And we always work it. Also, okay. Sort of, as far as the individual song is concerned, and also what will go with how the songs will sort of sound with each other. So it's basically sort of looking in terms of an album as opposed to just individual songs.
Yeah, we have tried in the past to provide a lot of variety on each album and a lot of contrasts. And so we've had to sort of have a good cross-section of material.
All right, well, let's hear some of the heavy side of your music, The March of the Black Queen from Queen 2. From Queen 2, March of the Black Queen. Brian, you can say something about Queen
2. I thought it was a good idea to play that because Queen 2 is an album which, in some ways, is the root of all that happened thereafter, I think. And I don't. If people haven't heard that before, I think you could hear that and think that that was something off the new album, really. It still sounds that fresh to me. And there are a lot of things that you can hear, that all the sort of texture work was there, and the intricate harmonies, the guitar harmonies and stuff, sort of the precursor of Bohemian Rhapsody in many ways. So I think that was a very important album for us. It was also the first one which came into the charts.
How long did March of the Black Queen take you to record?
The tape went transparent.
Yeah,
genuinely.
Those were the days of 16-track studios, and I think, wasn't it?
Yes, it was 16-track.
You have now 24 and 32-track. But, I mean, as we did so many overdubs, I mean, on 16-track, it was like we just kept piling it on and on, and it was like, that's what Roger means, and the tape went transparent because it just couldn't take anymore. I think it snapped in about two places.
It'd gone over the head so many times, and overdubbing, the oxide had worn off.
It was a big step for us at the time, certainly, because no one's really doing that kind of thing in those days.
In fact, when this album came out, we were doing our own first headlining tour after after supporting Mott the Hoople and gaining an enormous amount of live experience and a large following, really, for a relatively new band.
Well, then, Roger, you went on to support Mott the Hoople in the States, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed a logical step because it had worked so well and we got on with them very well personally as well, which doesn't always happen on tours, you know. Mm. It's always good if the bands that are touring together do get on well. And so we really took the logical step and went to America with them as well. And we did learn quite a lot of them. They were a really good live band.
Excellent live band, yeah.
We had a very good American tour up to the point when Brian got hepatitis and collapsed and we had to come home. At which point things look very black.
Well, then you did an extraordinary thing. Having supported once in England and having supported once in the States, you then went to headline straight away in England and then you went to headline straight away in the States.
It was quite rare then, yeah, because we did go to sort of playing the rainbow by ourselves in one sort of step.
We did take a lot of risks, actually. I think most of them paid off.
Most of them.
In the States, you got yourselves an American manager.
Well, we already had him, in fact. He was taken on by... But it helped us for when we went to America. Mm. He was taken on by Trident, which is the company which we were signed to at the time, the sort of production deal. And I think he helped in many ways with our introduction to America, being a Yank, you know. Mm-hmm. He was from California.
Basically, I think we'd signed all the deals, I mean, the recording deals and the publishing deals. So, in effect, we were signed to Trident, and at a later stage, Jack Nelson, who's the person we're talking about, came in to sort of look after the management side of things. So he was brought in at a later stage.
Yeah.
Sure.
We should make it a little clearer. When we came to the point of signing record contracts, there was a few record companies who were interested, but instead of doing that, we signed to a production company, and the deal is that you record for them, and they then do a deal with the record company, so you have a kind of middleman. And Trident with this middleman.
At the time, it seems a good idea because an established company, a fairly high power established company, seems more able to deal with the fairly high powered record companies than the mere novice,
humble musicians.
£20
a week musicians.
There is a huge basic drawback in the fact that your manager is then your record company, and you don't have anyone who can represent you to the record company. So you have an impossible situation where it's basically the band against everyone else, and it generated friction in every department.
All right, well, now we come on to your third album, Sheer Heart Attack, and the biggest hit from that, which went to number 2 in November 74, was Killer Queen.
She keeps them always shined on in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cakes, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. Insatiable and appetite. Wanna try?
Was this written about a lovely lady of your acquaintance then?
No, another fictitious person.
I mean, there's wonderful lyrics, and there's dynamite with a laser beam guaranteed to blow your mind, gunpowder, gelatine, I mean, marvellous stuff. But we're not going to get any clues. This society...
I think if I was to sort of analyse every verse, it would be very boring for the listeners, and it might sort of shatter a few illusions that others sort of kept it.
It's one that sticks in the mind, so anyway, it's very obvious that you're a painstakingly thorough, very methodical group. I mean, you're a perfectionist.
God, that sounds really boring, doesn't it?
No, but I mean, I think it's much to be admired, the fact that you go into every facet of production, not only just the music, you know, you see it right down to the last dot, as we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, we always thought that was essential, not only in the production, but in every detail that we're involved in.
We learned through hard experience, really.
Yeah, I mean, right down to the last bit of print on the record cover and the way it's cut on the album, which is crucial, right down to the way the tours are set up. Everything we try to keep control of.
Because where there's
it's
a lot
not
of,
easy.
There's so much money involved these days. I mean, it's sort of almost sordid to talk about the amounts of money, but they are involved. And people are very clever, and nothing corrupts like large sums of money. Mm. And so we do have to be very careful.
Let's go on to another track from Sheer Heart Attack. It's Bring Back That Leroy Brown. Bring back that Leroy Brown with a ukulele novelty from Brian May there. Brian, what would you describe this ukulele-type music as? As barbershop ukulele? Formby?
Yeah, the ukulele in a way was incidental to that, because that was Freddie's song, and it had this kind of vaudeville atmosphere, and I just thought a ukulele would go nicely on it, and we sort of worked it so that it could be done. And I managed to fiddle a little ukulele solo.
You, in fact, learnt on a ukulele, right?
Yes, that was the first instrument I ever played. My father had a genuine George Formby ukulele. George Formby was the originator of that kind of style of playing, which is rhythmic and slightly melodic at the same time, because he plays across the top and bottom strings to make little melodies. And I'm really a pretty poor imitator of that style, but I got interested in it from
that. She's sick,
didn't it? Oh, sorry.
Modesty.
And I believe your father also was instrumental in making your first guitar?
Yes, my father and I made the guitar together, which is still the one I use all the time.
And what was it made out of?
Lumps of wood bits and pieces. It cost about £8 to make in the beginning.
I mean, I read in a press biography, I think it was something about an armchair or a fireplace.
A 100-year-old fireplace, the legendary fireplace. Yes,
the things that are coming out of that fireplace. Quite
the neck was made out of an old fireplace, yes.
My goodness, you must have been quite a craftsman.
Well, we just worked at it for a couple of years, because I was at school and it was evenings and weekends and things.
I see. And that's still the one you play now?
Yes.
Oh, terrific. Well, it must be worth a fortune in years to come, so...
I don't know, really. It's really not worth very much to anyone except me, because everyone finds it difficult to play.
Can we come now to your producer, Roy Thomas Baker?
Roy half-produced the first album, and then he went on to become our full producer. Hmm. And I think Night at the Opera was the last one, and we co-produced it with him.
Freddie, did you select him, or did EMI provide him?
Well, it was through Trident, really.
It was all through Trident, yeah.
Because in the early days, you know, the first album, and then we had they stuck us with John Anthony, didn't they, as well? Mm. And we didn't really get on with him, so we gave him the elbow after one album. And then we did the second album with Roy and Robin Cable.
Yeah, Trident was quite a mecca for producers at the time, because I remember sort of all the Bowie's most successful stuff was done with Ken Scott there.
Yeah.
Let's have another track from Sheer Heart Attack. This is In the Lap of the Gods.
I
In the Lap of the Gods, the Beach Ooh. Boys meet Wagner, or something like that, anyway. Freddie, was this a sort of pre-runner to Bohemian Rhapsody? It has that sort of operatic feel to it.
I suppose it could be put across that way, yes. I'm sort of learning a lot in about... On this, on Sheer Heart Attack, we were doing a lot of things that was to come in future albums, or was to sort of be used on the future albums. And songs like that, yes, I suppose working out the kind of harmonies and things and the song structure did help a lot in, say, something like Bohemian Rhapsody. It's true. Somebody said this was something like Cecil B. DeMille meets Walt Disney or something, which is more to the point than, say, the Beach Boys.
Wagner meets the Beach Boys, yes. Well, now, talking about Cecil B. DeMille, can we come to your colossal stage productions with crowns appearing everywhere, thunder flashes all over the stage, and you leaping about, bringing ballet to the masses, I believe a quote was.
Oh, I mean, if you're referring to sort of a certain article about all that, that's meant to be taken tongue-in-cheek. But, I mean, it's just that... at this point in time, that's something that sort of interests me. And I'm just trying to incorporate it in the stage act. Nothing more, really. And it's basically to enhance the music we play. I mean, if it wasn't working, then I wouldn't do it. And it's also a phase that I'm going through. And I like the Nijinsky costume.
The people who come to the show seem to really enjoy them, because you must aim for maximum effect, which we do. I mean, both orally and visually. However, some sort of people... don't seem to like this so-called purist or whatever, and they think it's techno flash rock or something, I've heard it called. But basically, we're just trying to put over the music and the visual aspect as effectively as we can to as many people as we can.
Do you carry your own lighting crew all over the world?
Yes.
So it's the same one that was at Ellscott that was in the States, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. It has to be, because the coordination required is quite unbelievable.
Yeah. And the same for the sound setup. The way we started off, we always had these big ideas, and we always thought that it should be a visual and a sound experience. It should be a complete thing that you can wallow in, you know. I think it comes from when we were kids. If we went to see a rock band, we wanted to be knocked out. We wanted to be blown away.
Yeah.
You know, and
stunned.
Yeah, it's for that kind of thing. We think it should be a real event every time we play.
People are paying money to come and see you. So
yes, as far as we're concerned, we're putting on a show. It's not just us. Just another rendition of an album. If that was the case, we might as well just have sort of cardboard cutouts and just play the album through the sort of system.
I mean,
right. Let's have some more music. The next one from Sheer Heart Attack we're going to play is Now I'm Here.
Call that music. Here I stand.
Now I'm Here, which went to number 11 in February 75. Do you find that the single helps you generate sale of an album?
Definitely. That's what gets you to the mass of people. Even if they don't buy it, and even if they don't like it, they still know who you are from a single. Whereas I think you could have a number one album for 6 months and people still wouldn't know who you were. But we never record any record as a single. It's always just a track off an album that we think might make a good single after we've recorded it.
Oh, I see. So you don't go into the studio, this is going to be the one?
No, never. We never have.
Do you take advice from other people as to what could be a good single?
Never.
No.
Next.
It never works.
Nobody wanted Bohemian Rhapsody as a single, really.
Really?
Around us, everyone says no one would play it because it was too long and all that stuff.
Nobody except us wanted it.
But this is not to say that we're always right, because we're not.
Well, we're not always right.
We've been
wrong.
The choice of a single is...
Yeah, once.
There's a very difficult thing. I mean, there's no sure fire hit, you know. It's just, there's no such thing. And would say something like Bohemian Rhapsody, it was a big risk and it worked. Because I think with a song like that, it was either going to be a huge success or a terrific flop. Mm. And, you know, it was...
But it's been no bed of roses.
No pleasure cruise. No.
Well, we're talking about Bohemian Rhapsody, so let's play Bohemian Rhapsody now. Bohemian Rhapsody. This was, for me, so amazing because it was such a departure from anything else that was in the charts in 75. In November, it got to number one and stayed there for 9 weeks, I think, didn't it? Amazing.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Terrific amount of time. Anyway, yonks and yonks, and it was fabulous. Freddie, can you tell us a bit about how you recorded Bohemian Rhapsody, the actual technical side of it?
You want a few trade secrets? It was quite a mammoth task because it was basically done in three definite sections and just pieced together. And each one required a lot of concentration. The opera section in the middle was the most taxing, I think, because we wanted to recreate a sort of huge operatic sort of harmony section between just the three of us. And that involves a lot of multi-tracking and things. And I think between the three of us, we sort of... we recreated a sort of 160 to 200 piece
something
choir
like, yeah.
effect between just the three of us, as Brian, Roger and myself.
There's a tremendous range of harmonies, yes. and it involves doing it again and again and again and again to make it sound bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm.
Can you think how many times to get that number of people?
Well, divide 200 by 3. Something like that.
Yeah, 66.
This is for each little part.
Each
so
little bit, though,
by...
has to be done that many times. Mm. You have to learn all the very different parts, because I think some of them were... What, how many part harmonies?
Because, I mean, like, there was a section of no, 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 and we had to sort of do that and sort of different escalating things, and we just sat there going, no, 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 about... I don't know, 150 times.
Going out of our minds.
Does one of you every now and again get saying, no more, that's it.
Oh, yes.
All the time.
Yeah. All the time.
Yeah. And then the others sort of egg him on and say, well, is anyone more or
depends
something?
Depends on who's...
No, everybody agrees and we leave.
Well, we come now to Freddie's personal choice of music. Freddie, what's it going to be?
I've sort of chosen an Aretha Franklin track. I think it's called You've Got a Friend. It's from the... Amazing Grace album, which she did a long time ago. It's a live, so I think, double album set. It's a sort of gospel thing which she did live in a church in California, I think. It's called You Got a Friend.
Yeah, you got a friend in Jesus.
Freddie Mercury's choice there from Aretha Franklin. Radio 1 presents the second part of Queen. In the first program, we covered the musical development of Queen from their first album right up to their chart-topping single Bohemian Rhapsody. And in the second program, we'll be talking again to Queen about their music. We'll be playing tracks from A Night at the Opera, Day at the Races, and News of the World. First of all, then, let's go to Queen's drummer, Roger Taylor. I've noted down here, Roger, that when you're not playing or recording with Queen, you're quite interested in motor racing and in cars.
Well, more cars, really. I'm not that up on motor racing. I have auto sport every week. But, I mean, really, this is a full-time job. It keeps us so busy, I would never get time to go to any races or anything. I just like cars.
Hmm.
They're rather nice.
But you have driven, haven't you?
Only once, yeah. It was a very minor thing, really. But it gives you a taste, you know.
You're not thinking of taking on Noel Edmonds down at Ryan's Hatch or something?
Oh, good God, I'd thrash him.
Hear that, Noel? Right.
Before he got in the car.
Yeah, that's even before he got in.
Anyway, that's our natural cue to I'm in Love with My Car by Roger Taylor. I'm in Love with My Car from A Night at the Opera. John, I believe you're very interested in stereo photography.
Stereo photography, yeah.
Tell us about stereo photography.
It's just like the old Weetabix things, you know, where you used to get the two things with the viewers. You used to get two pictures, you know, both taken from a slightly different position, and you look through a special viewer, and you get a true 3D perspective effect. And you can have attachments that you actually put on cameras, on special stereo cameras, to take three-dimensional pictures.
Three-dimensional slides?
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, you can't sort of project it, can you?
There is a means. You've tried it, haven't you, Brian, projecting?
Yeah, I got quite a long way into it, yeah. You can do it with a silver screen instead of a white screen and cross Polaroids and things.
Mm.
Takes a lot of setting up. It's very interesting.
Perfect for the average layman.
Brian...
It's very unfashionable at the moment because it was quite a successful form of photography in the 1920s and 30s or so, but it sort of went out of fashion for some unknown reason, because I think it's amazing.
Mm. Brian, I would have thought you'd have been interested too in holograms and...
Yes, strangely enough, holography was invented by Dennis Gabor, who was a professor at my college, at Imperial College, where I went. So we had a holography course. Yes, I was interested. I don't really think it has as much application to the rock stage as people think.
You don't think you could incorporate holograms into your act?
You can, but it's the art is not at the state where it's going to be... that good at the moment. The Who really are the people who've got most into using lasers as part of the stage show. But holography is a very dicey business, really, even with lasers. And to produce large-scale, impressive things is more difficult than people think.
Mm. I believe they're far more advanced than we are in the States with holograms.
Yes, it's surprising, though. I mean, I keep vaguely up with the developments, but it hasn't advanced hugely on the large scale. The small-scale making of holograms commercially has advanced considerably. But problems are still the same. You need a large source of coherent light, and you need a screen to work the thing from. You can't suspend it in thin air yet, the image.
And back to John again. You're playing the electric piano on the next track, You're My Best Friend. How did you wrench the piano away from Freddie?
Well, Freddie didn't like the electric piano, so I took it home, and I started to... Because I'd never played piano before, and I really started to learn on the electric piano, and basically that's a song that came out, you know, when I was learning to play piano.
I refused to play the damn thing.
Well, was this a question of ethics, or what?
Tinny and horrible. I don't like them. Why play those things when you've got a lovely, super grand piano? No, I think it's... Basically, what he's trying to say is that there was a desired effect, really, in that.
It was written on that instrument, and really it sounds best on that, you know, on the instrument that you wrote a song on.
Well, it got to number 7 in July 76, You're My Best Friend. You're My Best Friend, with John fingering away like fury on electric piano. Now we come to the grand subject of marketing A Night at the Opera. It's a fascinating subject. How did you conceive the album sleeve and everything else, and how did you go about marketing it?
Well, the sleeve had a sort of crest on it, didn't it? That's right.
And now you designed that, right?
Well, it was an adaptation of an earlier crest that I did. It was done by David Costa, who sort of worked in conjunction with us, and we made sure it's what we wanted. Since then, I mean, as far as, say, marketing is concerned, it's a huge process. I mean, it covers such a wide area. Yeah, it's like we said before, we sort of work on the album material, and then we choose a single. In this case, the Night at the Opera case, it happened to be Bohemian Rhapsody, and with that we made a film, which helped us a lot. I mean, we did it with Bruce Gowers.
Yeah, we just made a film.
A promotional
in
film.
Rather short time, actually. We were just before we went out to tour in England, when Bohemian Rhapsody was released, we were rehearsing up at Elstree, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And they just came in one night with a video truck, one or two little bits, and we did it in about 4 hours, didn't we?
Yes. Mm. The film opened up a new avenue for us, because the film was used all around the world and worked very successfully. It didn't only just get the record across, it got Queen across, both visually and sort of orally. And now it's really a part of the accepted pattern of marketing a single for any major, or in fact even a new band these days, or artist, to make the record, and they bring out the record, but they always have the film with the record. In fact, you can sell that film around the whole world and literally promote your records with it without actually being there. I think ABBA have turned that into great advantage, yes.
John, how deeply do you involve yourselves with the marketing?
We involve ourselves artistically with the product, basically. I mean, obviously the album, the cover and the film, we're very much involved with that. But as far as the actual sort of marketing, I mean, a lot is up to the record company, you know. As long as they don't do anything that is grossly in bad taste, you know, and we like to keep an eye on what they're doing.
Have you ever had a nasty shock, something you weren't expecting?
Oh, yes. There have been a few things. Yeah.
Posters.
Yeah, there's been some really bad things. There was one particular example in America we were very upset about, where they put out Liar as a second single. Mm. And when we heard it, we discovered that they'd chopped a good 60% of it out, just in a pretty random way, not even done the edits very well. And that was being put out as a single in America, and of course it was a flop. And we've always tried to fight for complete artistic control throughout the world. The normal thing is to send your copies of the master tapes when you finish the album to various countries, and they cut it. Now, in cutting a record, which is actually physically putting it on the disc, there's a huge amount you can do with it, and you can completely ruin a record which has been taken months to produce. Mm-hmm. And we've got some of the cuts back from countries that we didn't know about, and they've been horrific. It's funny, the first album in America was an interesting example, because they put it all through a very vicious limiter, which means that everything comes up to the same level. and everything pumps. They call it pumping. So if you have a continuous note and a drum beat on top, then the continuous note goes up and down around the drum beat. And in fact, that improved some tracks, or made them... It's very strange. It gave them a particular
sound. We
really
knew a lot about the studio then.
It gave them a particular sound on American FM radio, which we discovered when we went there, that it did get us across very well. And we sort of... We actually used that on subsequent albums. It's very strange how things can happen.
Let's have some more music. Brian, let's take one of yours. One that we're going to play of yours in a minute from Night at the Opera, which is called Good Company, which has a George Formby-style ukulele on it and trad jazz. Were you interested a lot in trad jazz?
I can remember the trad jazz boom, and I was very keen on a group called the Temperance Seven, who did, in fact, a sort of revival of the 20s arrangements for a jazz band. And that's the kind of thing I was going after on this track.
Take good care of what you've got, my father said to me, as he puffed his pipe and baby bee dandled on his knee. Don't fool with fools who turn away, keep all good company.
Well, Brian, now we come to your personal record choice, and I believe instead of just having one, you're going to have half of one and half another.
Yes, I'm very greedy.
Well, tell us what they're going to be.
Okay, this is going to bring us on to Jimi Hendrix, who I'm sure we can talk a lot about. I'd like to play the beginning of a track called A House Burning Down. The beginning of this, to me, is the most amazing attacking beginning to a song I've ever heard, and it's the complete production job on guitars, bass and drums. I've never heard anything like it. And the other track is Angel Bird Can Sing, which is, I think, is just something that's very simple and very beautiful that the Beatles did. There's a lot of Beatles in us, I think. A lot of influence there, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And that was one of the things which I liked. A very simple song, very well done. And also, a little bit of double tracking from George Harrison. I assume it's George, playing the little figures that go around the vocals. And that was an inspiration as well, because one of my dreams was to be able to do multi-tracking guitar on records. At that time, it was unheard of to do double tracking. I could name about three instances to do proper harmony work with a rock-sounding guitar. Yeah. And George Harrison was quite a pioneer, because he had a go at it on this track.
Tell me that you got everything you want.
Brian May's choice from Jimi Hendrix, A House Burning Down, and The Beatles, And Your Bird Can Sing. And now, can we talk about Jimi Hendrix? Because I know Jimi Hendrix has been a prime mover to the group and a great influence to you all. Freddie?
He was just a beautiful man. I think he was just a master showman. No, what can I say? He's just a dedicated musician. I mean, he was just everything as far as I was concerned. And I went to numerous places to sort of try and catch his shows. Just magic, just magic. And it was really... It's quite sort of a treat to watch somebody just come on stage. I mean, he didn't have the kind of props and things that we have today. It all emitted from him, you know, from the person. It was just him and the guitar, very colourful. And just, it was quite a stage act. You learnt a lot from that kind of thing.
Roger, I believe that when he died, you were at the Kensington Market, right?
That's true, see, yes. How did you find that out?
I was...
Yes. Yeah, I remember...
We shut shop in his honour.
Yeah, we shut up our stall and went home and had a good ball. Because it
made all his records.
Really, it was dreadful when he died, for me, yeah. Mm.
I also believe that when you did your big Hyde Park concert last year, that was on the anniversary of Jimmy's death.
It was.
Tell us about Hyde Park. How did that come about?
It was an idea we had while we were touring in Japan. We thought it would be nice to do something different in England rather than do the same old, you know, yeah, tour, etc., the same old places. And we thought we'd like to do a free concert. And the best possible venue that occurred to us was Hyde Park, because it was more central than any other. It was an awful lot of trouble to get permission to play in the park, to hold the event. It cost us a fortune, etc. But in the end, it was worth it. We wanted to just make a good gesture, to do something for nothing. A lot of people still don't seem to realise that. I mean, there was no percentage from any angle in it, really.
Well, let's have some more music, this time from A Day at the Races and Somebody to Love, which got to the top 10 in December 76. Find me somebody to love. Somebody to Love, with a very gospel-sounding choir. Freddie, was that choir built up in the same way as you did on Bohemian Rhapsody?
In a way, yes. I mean, we had the same three people singing on the big choir sections. But I think it had a different kind of technical approach, because, I mean, it was a sort of gospel way of singing, which I think was different to us. And this is me sort of going on about Aretha Franklin, and sort of made him go a bit mad. I just wanted to write something in that kind of thing. I was sort of incensed by the sort of gospel approach that she had on her albums, in the earlier albums. Mm. Although it might sound the sort of same kind of approach on, say, the harmonies, it is very different in the studio, because it's sort of like a different kind of... it's a different range.
Can we come now to the territories in which you're very enormous? I understand you're huge in Japan. Can we hear about...
It's as if you swell up as soon as since you arrived there.
So that sake is. Well, tell us about Japan. Why Japan? I know Freddie sings in Japanese, right?
Only on one song.
Yeah, I mean, that was more of a tribute, I think.
That was a long time after. Really.
You know, Japan really caught on to us fairly early on.
Queen 2, I think, was the big one they picked up on, really, wasn't it?
And we knew that there was a sort of demand for us there, and so we sort of tagged it on to the end of an American tour. We had a holiday in Hawaii, and then it was sort of logical. So we went there, and we arrived at the airport and suddenly realised it was on a scale different to that which we'd imagined, because there were thousands of people there just to welcome us, you know, and normally you just don't get that sort of thing anywhere. We've had two really amazing tours in Japan since then. They sort of seem to take us to their hearts, and I think we've had some influences from them, especially Brian, I think.
Which brings me to the next one. I mean, how do you get on when you're not on stage? Do you all mix together, or do you all go off your separate ways?
I don't know. It's hard to, a bit of both, really.
In America, we have a limousine each. We just, the moment we finish, just get into that and do our own bit.
Go to four corners of the town.
So it is that.
It really depends. I mean, if there's a reception later on or whatever.
Depends, actually, yeah. We've grown apart a bit more, you know. But, I mean, we don't hate each other yet, which I think quite a lot of other bands do.
Well, this is very apt, this next title, because it's Let Us Cling Together, or... Now, Freddie, you pronounce it for me.
Te Otoriate.
Teo Toriati. Brian, this is a very reflective, quiet song, which contrasts rather with the next song, which is Tie Your Mother Down. How can we get two such opposite songs on the same album?
I don't know. We do tend to be attracted by opposites, if that's the right way of putting it. We tend to, if we go a long way in a particular direction, we tend to like to go equally far in the opposite direction. I think we still feel that we're kind of doing our apprenticeship in that we can try out anything that comes into our heads. If a song comes along and suggests a certain approach, you've written down reflective approach here, okay, then we'll follow that to its extreme, and at the same time, if another song comes up which is the heavy kind of stuff, then we'll follow that to its extreme. And I think that's one of our strong points internally.
We're not scared of trying out different ideas, you know. I think one of the things that we really steer clear of is trying to sort of repeat the same formula.
The old thing of light and shade, really. Yes.
It keeps the interest.
Which all the best rock bands have had on stage. I mean, the rock bands which have the most impact are the people who can do a slow song and then flatten the whole place with a complete contrast. Yeah. That's what gets me, anyway. If somebody comes on stage and blasts 12-bar blues all night, then there comes a point, I think, where it sags in the middle, although I love it, I mean, I love hard rock well played, and I think it's the hardest thing to do in some ways. But the way to do it is not to sort of rock and roll all night, as far as I'm concerned. It's to do everything in its right place.
Mm. Well, let's have Tie Your Mother Down. Tie Your Mother Down from A Day at the Races. Can we talk about your manager, John Reed, at the moment? He also manages Elton John, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
He's very successful. Good manager. Well, I think good management is pretty vital. Yeah.
It is.
Mm. It's totally vital.
Especially, say, for a band that's sort of starting up. I mean, they need the guidance and things, so a good manager is definitely
And you need
vital.
Somebody to take at least some of the worries away that aren't to do with the music away from you.
Well, we're a very difficult group to manage. We demand a lot.
Let us progress on this one. Now, there have been incorrect newspaper reports, I believe, that you were about to decamp for the States because of tax reasons. Mm. Roger, can we go on that one? Yeah. How did that occur?
Well, it was basically, I must have been something that I said, but it was. It was certainly. It was taken completely wrongly. Whatever it was, I said. I certainly didn't say we were going off to America tomorrow, which was how the article came out. It's something that we might do in the future, but definitely in the future. Certainly not tomorrow, and or even next month, or the month after.
But we are going to America for a tour.
Yes, we're going for a tour.
A tour.
But we're not leaving England yet.
I see, but they took it as though you were...
Becoming tax exiles, really.
Becoming tax exiles, that was how it's written up, yes. It really was.
Live abroad, yeah.
What I gathered from what it said, I mean, you do an interview, which is why we've learnt not to do many, and you sort of read it back, and you think, good God, was I there? Mm. And really? People just sort of tend to turn things around to say what they really want to say, you know, whether it be the politics of one particular newspaper. The article will sound as they want to sound it, or the editor wants it to sound, as opposed to the interviewee.
Now, when you say something, somebody slaps a writ on you or sues you, can't you then sue them?
It depends. I'd rather go around and smack them in the teeth, personally. But, I haven't had any writs surfed on me.
Well, that sounds the old-fashioned way to do it, which brings us to good old-fashioned love of boy.
Corny.
Hey, boy, where'd you get it from? Hey, boy, where did you go? I love my passion in the good old-fashioned school of love of boy.
There were four songs on the EP, but it was priced at the price of a single, I believe. Why was
this?
We
just wanted to give something that was sort of quite good value and that was a good sort of sample of one track from the last four albums, I think.
I went into the top 20 June 77, so was it for the Jubilee? Was this a special...
Not really, I don't think.
We wanted something released to coincide with the tour that we were doing at the time, and as we didn't have any new product, because, I mean, we... The way we did it this time was we did a tour and then we were going to go in the studio and do the new album, which is News of the World.
Roger, we now come to you and your personal choice here.
Yeah, it's very hard to choose one record. All I could think of was a record that really excited me at the time. And it's a record by one of the best bands ever, I think, and still are, the Who. Very exciting. It was their second hit single. And it, as far as production in those days was concerned, it's the most over-the-top record I've ever heard. It had the first use of feedback that I can remember, I think, on record. It's called Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere.
I can go anyway without you.
Anyhow, Anyway, Anywhere from The Who. Your fan club is one of the biggest fan clubs in the world, with about 45,000 people. And I believe you do a very nice thing that you send them little personal letters that are then photocopied. Brian?
Yeah, we try and keep in contact. We think it's very important to keep that sort of two-way thing going. It's not the easiest thing to run. There are a lot of pitfalls in running fan clubs. You know, you can become too detached or you can become too involved and not get any of your actual work done. You know, so you have to... I think it's important that we are kept in touch with all the reaction, you know, and the girls that work for us in the fan club and a guy now who's doing the organisational side, really make sure that there is this two-way communication all the time. Mm. We try and keep the fan club as an information service. That was what it was started off with, rather than as a promotion vehicle, because I think many fan clubs become tainted with that. If you start using it purely as a selling device, the whole thing becomes horrible. Mm.
Roger, in the last week of August, you put out your own personal single, which was called I Want to Testify, which you sang and you played every instrument on the single. Tell us about this.
It's not a particularly big deal. It was just something. We came back from America and there's a sort of slack period and I was a bit sort of bored. I had nothing to do. But I just went into the studio with our engineer, Mike Stone, and did an old song by the Parliaments. I've got a version, an a cappella version. I just sort of heavied it up a bit and did it all by myself, just really as an experiment and a bit of fun. However, I found the experiment was slightly more expensive than anticipated. And a lot of people seemed to quite like it, so it was sort of eventually came out as a single.
There we go. I Want to Testify. Sung, played and everything else by Roger Taylor. Mm. But has it then sort of given you food for thought to the future?
After five, six albums, I think a lot of areas have opened up and there are lots of things that one can do, and I think already we're sort of branching out and doing other things, just from here.
With the financial reward that being a success, you know, of being a successful pop group. Obviously now, Freddie, I mean, you could open up a fine art business, couldn't you?
See my gallery. They call it a museum.
Has this crossed your mind that, you know, things you can now plan to do with the finance you've accumulated?
Yes, I think one must definitely invest. That's what my accountant says. I, for one, sort of started up a little production company of my own, and I have signed to it a person called Peter Straker. So that's a little venture that I've sort of got myself into, you know, alongside Queen, which is obviously the major thing.
Now we come to your new album.
This is called News of the World.
News of the World. All right, and I see down in front of me the first track is Sheer Heart Attack. Now, Roger, you wrote this one. Tell us about Sheer Heart Attack.
Yeah, it might sound vaguely familiar. It was written in essence, not completely. It wasn't finished.
Essence of brilliant.
At the time of recording Sheer Heart Attack, we didn't have room. It wasn't quite finished, except for a number of reasons. It didn't get on. And now it's been sort of... It lives again. And actually, I'm quite pleased with it. It's really pure energy. And it's one of my contributions to the new album.
Sheer Heart Attack. Now we come to John Deacon's song, Spread Your Wings. John, we haven't heard from you in a long time. Tell us about Spread Your Wings.
Just one of the two tracks I happen to have come up with, you know, this year and managed to squeeze on the album.
Squeeze is right.
John, does songwriting come easily to you?
No, it's quite difficult, actually. It's just getting a little bit better as time goes on. You know, I only started, really, the Sheer Heart Attack album. I had a little track called Misfire, but Best Friend was the real sort of first proper-length song I wrote, really. So I'm sort of still new to it, but it's improving anyway.
Do you compose on your electric piano?
Piano, guitar. I don't actually tend to compose much on the bass. Usually on either on just a sort of acoustic guitar or perhaps a piano.
Spread Your Wings from John Deacon.
Sammy was low, just watching the show over and over again. Knew it was time.
Before we have our finale, which is going to be We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions, can Brian, as you wrote We Will Rock You, can we ask you about We Will Rock You, and then we'll go to Freddie for We Are the Champions, who wrote that one. So, Brian, We Will Rock You.
Right. We have two kind of chanty songs, in a way. We Will Rock You was an experiment. The thing it's designed to simulate it is the effect of an audience just stomping and clapping and the singing and nothing else. So there's not supposed to be any bass or drums or guitar or anything. The guitar comes in the end and plays along with it. Just an experimental thing, really. And we're waiting to see what's going to happen on stage.
Can I just ask you, has News of the World cost you more than A Night at the Opera or Day of the Roses?
It might, in fact, be less.
It could be less. We spent less actual time, which was deliberate. We came back from a tour of Europe, which we hadn't done for a long time. We didn't mention Europe, but in fact we neglected Europe up until last year, and we did a proper tour and came back, and we had very little time left to make the album.
It's really a new departure, you know, because it's a more spontaneous album.
All right, OK. Freddie, We Are the Champions. I know you are, but tell us about We Are the Champions.
It's the most egotistical and arrogant song I've ever written.
Was it at all influenced by Elton John and Watford? Or?
Oh, no.
An interesting thing that may be worth mentioning, one of the best gigs we did on the last British tour was Bingley, which is new for us. Mm-hmm. And We did an encore and went off, and instead of just keeping on clapping, they sang You'll Never Walk Alone to us. And we were completely knocked out and taken aback, and it was quite an emotional experience, really. And I think these chant things are in some way connected with that kind of feeling, really.
Well, gents, it only remains for me to wish you a very successful 1978.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Your big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing, we will rock you. I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime, and bad mistakes I've made a few.